Hello, and welcome to On Tap, a theater and performance studies podcast. I'm Panel Camp of Washington University in St. Louis. I am joined on today's recording by Brian Herrera of Princeton University. Brian, it's nice to see you again. Happy vernal equinox. The official first day of spring was yesterday. I'm curious if you marked this this occasion, if you felt it in your life, in your existence in some way. What does springtime equinox Brian Herrera have going on?
I suspect that most times in my life, and this was the case this year, whether in New Mexico or the Northeast, I dressed for spring, and it did not feel like spring when I walked in the world dressed for spring. So yeah. I didn't choose to dress for spring because of any awareness of vernal equinox, but it just seemed right. And then I went outside, and I was only walking for a little bit, but I thought I was going to freeze myself off. So
Yeah. It's not too different here. Here the sun is out. The long Midwestern gray winter seems to be over, but you know, temperatures in the high 30s and 40s, so freezing, kind of cold as well, but great jogging weather. Great weather to get outside and run. Brian and I are joined as well on the recording by Shayoni Mitra of Barnard College. Shayoni, wonderful to see you again. And same question, did you feel the equinox? Did you anticipate it? Is this a moment in your yearly cycle that you look forward to? Talk equinox with us.
I will say I follow this account, and I don't know how much sense it makes to others, but on Twitter it's called New York Metro Weather, who rates the vibes each day. And sometimes you will get the vibes are immaculate. But the account was very quick to remind us we are in the second false spring. And, you know, there will be a second winter after that. An actual spring will be maybe an hour, and then we will go to sweltering heat. So I feel a little bit like there's a switch and bait going on. We don't know what to expect. But we will look forward to an hour of actual perfect weather sometime in the future.
Well, I hope it's one that you're fully prepared for, doesn't escape your attention. This is all of this sort of discussion of I guess it's astronomy. Is it astronomy when you're talking about the Earth's position around the sun? I don't know. But we have a solar eclipse coming, which will pass the path of totality. I think it goes from the northeast to the south of the United States and passes very close to St. Louis. Where I live will be not in the zone of totality, but in a partial eclipse. Will it be near where you two are in the New York, New Jersey area?
You know,
I have no idea.
I was nerdy enough to check, and I think Syracuse, it's upstate will be path of totality. And I did check to see, but it's a teaching day, so I will not be driving up. But I think it's fun because the last time I was on a path of totality was in India in the late 90s. And, you know, you get these insane projections of next time it'll be 2024. And I'm like, wow, that was really my past self looking forward to being here somewhere in North America for this.
I recommend, there was one a few years ago that also passed, the zone of totality went through the state of Missouri, and we drove about an hour, and I got to be in the path of totality for a solar eclipse, and that was fantastic. Don't know that we'll do it this time, but it is one of those really special events that if you're able to get to it, I recommend doing it. And you can cast it, you can think of it as a performance event. The Aztecs actually were able to predict eclipses, and they would gather, and they would have ceremonial practices around it. So it belongs to the broad spectrum category of performance, the solar eclipse. So these sort of momentous occasions named and acknowledged, we're ready to talk about what we have on the podcast today. We read Elisa Julina's Theater of Capital, Modern Drama and Economic Life. This is a brand new title out from Northwestern University Press in their Performance Works series, which is edited by Patrick Anderson and Nick Rideout. This is a critical reevaluation of many key works in modern drama from a materialist perspective. We watched a stream, which I'm afraid is no longer available, but we caught it right before it went offline, of Sasha Denisova's play My Mama and the Full-Scale Invasion. This was a co-production by the Wilma Theater and Woolly Mammoth. We'll talk about that. And finally, we wanted to check in and have a bit of time to talk about the 10th anniversary event, the convening of the Latinx Theater Commons, which took place, I guess, about a week ago, March 14 through 16, hosted by Arts Emerson in Boston. And Brian, of course, is someone who's been quite involved with that organization and was there. So we're excited to hear how that went and talk about the significance of this 10th anniversary. Before we get to our topics, of course, I would like to start by saying that I'm recording in my office at WashU in St. Louis, which is situated on the ancestral land of several indigenous groups, including the Osage Nation, the Miseria Tribe, the Miami people, and the Illini Confederacy. In 1808, the Osage Nation ceded its lands by treaty under threat of destruction by the United States Army. So I want to acknowledge this history, as I do on every episode. I want to thank the Booter Center for American Indian Studies here at WashU for making this information accessible and for all the work that they do. And I encourage our listeners to learn more about the territory where they live and go to our website, ontappod.com, and check out the land acknowledgement page for more. So first up, we read Elisa Julina's new book, Theater of Capital, Modern Drama and Economic Life. It's a really interesting book. I got a lot out of it. I'm going to try to sort of encapsulate it before opening up for discussion. So it's I would call it a materialist reevaluation of modern drama through fresh readings of plays, including a lot of plays by what I would consider canonical figures in that formation of modern drama. Ibsen, there's a substantial first chapter on Ibsen, Strindberg, Shaw, Chekhov, Gerhard Hauptmann. Their works are discussed, as well as works by some playwrights such as Victoria Benedictsson, a Swedish playwright who don't appear as commonly in modern drama syllabi or in the anthologies. So Julina contributes readings of the plays, and that forms, I'd say, the core of the work. But it also incorporates intellectual history, positing that the concern with economics of the era of modern drama, reactions to the various social effects of industrial capitalism, which included the philosophy of Karl Marx and Engels, that these same concerns also affected the thinking and writing of these modernist writers. So you see in a variety of treatments over several different playwrights from different nations, et cetera, the ways that money, that capital, that invisible labor are all very present concerns in these works. But it also branches out into analysis of contemporary performances. So it's not all just readings of plays that are more or less familiar from the late 19th and early 20th century. But Julina looks at revivals, adaptations of some of these works, including the 2010 production of The Weavers by the theater department at Dhaka University of Bangladesh, which, as she points out, happened 3 years prior to the Rana Plaza catastrophe, a massive disaster involving a garment factory in Bangladesh that collapsed, killing, I think, 1,100 people. And also Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' recent adaptation of Enemy of the People, and some contemporary work, including Ayad Akhtar's 2014 play, The Invisible Hand. Those analyses are all in the mix as well. But I feel as though the sort of core of it is, selective and intensive readings of canonical works from modern drama that, though Julina doesn't come out and say, we could reevaluate the entire category of modern drama along materialist lines, the sum total of all of these different playwrights that she examines and offers a fresh perspective on suggests that indeed that modern drama could be reconceived along lines that look at that as a kind of cultural reaction to processing of meditation and representation of the forces of capitalist economic development, especially in Western Europe, European contexts. So that's my sort of gloss on the book and its contribution. I'm curious to know what the two of you thought reading it. I'll just say, by rather than just a completely open prompt, I'll say that one of the things that I was considering reading this is the way that the idea, the category of modern drama, it had me rethinking that, because I think in literary studies there's a another sort of current tradition which is modernist studies, like reconceiving the idea of modernism in a sort of broad way, and then there's the idea of modern drama, which in my training I learned to attribute to the kind of canonical forming publications of anthologies by Eric Bentley, that three-volume textbook by J.L. Stein, that sort of forms the idea that there is this discrete theatrical literary tradition called modern drama. And not being someone who studies modernism myself or you know, has a special research specialty in it, it had me considering to what extent the category of modern drama is still something really present in training programs in theater and performance studies and what it means in the 21st century. So I don't know. Does that prompt any reflections on your parts? Did you have other ideas about modern drama as a category reading this book?
I can jump in here to say it's not just the category of modern drama, but I think a very compelling link that she makes is what is its relation to realism and how are those two categories linked, right? And I think and this appears sort of late in the introduction, but this idea that, you know, these canonical playwrights, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shaw, Strindberg, are thinking through the contradictions of capital and capitalism as a practice on stage, when not just the economy, but a certain idea of political economy itself becomes sort of staged. And her central argument to me, I think, is that theater is able to stage these really, she calls them internal contradictions of capitalism. And to what extent then do those contradictions get played out in the realist form? And she has a very sort of interesting take there about, she calls it that the intimacy of this kind of theater allows or enables the critique of it, right? So shorthand, you're both a part of the capitalist sort of enterprise in this kind of theatrical playmaking, and you see its problems, and so you're able to stage it in this kind of dramatic way.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. So she cites the Mark Fisher's category of capitalist realism as a sort of reference point in that introduction. But you're quite right, Shayoni, that I think that the main idea, as announced in the introduction, is that these playwrights are involved in imminent critique, right, that involves the spectators who were presumed to be members of the bourgeoisie, but which the theatrical form and the realist mode allow for those contradictions to be staged.
Yeah, I would agree that I think that this really did help me revisit why I find, you know, it was a sort of a comfort basically for me of going through and revisiting these plays through a very fresh and activated lens, plays that I've known or taught or had engagements with in all different ways because of their very canonicity and just because of the idiosyncrasy of my own undergraduate education. But I think the thing I really appreciated was the fact that I had sort of absorbed, and I'm embarrassed to sort of admit the banality of what I had absorbed in terms of the genealogy, is basically I had absorbed the triumphalist narrative of the modern drama, of the era of modern drama, as being turning from the moralism of melodrama to the intellectual seriousness of modernism, which tended to anchor things in form. And here what I see is something, she's making a case that The moralism didn't necessarily go away. The melodrama didn't necessarily go away. The well-made play didn't necessarily go away. But the questions that the plays, that the playwrights were asking actually do have some affinities across that help us understand what this new formation was questions of social power, questions of social access, questions of limitation, but often in this space of what she talks about, the great hook of capitalism, which is ambivalence. You know, every near miss is a near hit. You know, it's that pivot of the next one could be the one, this kind of space of ambivalence and uncertainty, but also great promise. And so I think it really, for me, just helped me sort of understand why I really enjoy still, like, I just taught Mrs. Warren's Profession. My students were like, what? But I was like, no, we got to get into what, why use theater to put these ideas in play and to embody character and have characters not necessarily embodying ideologies, but not embodying ideologies. Like, what is it when they, and then arguing about it, and then having something like marriage and love and future and all this stuff in the mix, like what does theater enable us to do? And that's, I think, one of the things that I found most compelling in really explaining to me why the ending of Uncle Vanya just always knocks me flat on my ass, which is this space of how the theatrical enterprise is actually, these playwrights all seize upon it as a capitalist venture of consumption, that this is this kind of thing where we are watching these people who are being paid to, like, the paradox of anything, any sort of serious play in a commercial context is going to involve something like somebody paid for it. These people are being paid to be here. I paid to be here. And sort of this transactional access to these ideas, these transactional intimacies, is something that she really names as part of what these playwrights understand. And she really goes deep into why Chekhov really understands this kind of... the paradox of this ambivalence of, like, here we are, we're stuck in this system and we're all making choices, but who knows? And so I just think it just gave me a really fresh way to appreciate what I continue to appreciate about this sort of subset of the canon. And I found myself, what I found most generative about the model that she, because I sort of saw it as sort of like what happens when these playwrights are thinking through financialization and all this kind of these new turns. And I started thinking alongside, like, I found it a really generative model to think alongside plays that weren't of this era. You know, like, I was thinking a lot about a couple Fornes plays because she's always thinking about economic inequity. And I was thinking, like, oh, this actually helps me see that and see that and see that. And it really makes me understanding, not in a kind of instrumentalist way or any kind of didactic way, but the question of how, what John Rossini in his work on Latinx playwrights talks about, how playwrights are also theorizing social formation as they are inventing social formation on the stage. And so this idea of what, of to understand the playwright, not as playwriter, but playwright, somebody who writes, but somebody who builds as a shipwright. And so what is the world being built, and what is the theoretical foundation of the world being built? And that's the foundation of what John Rossini does to say what is distinctive about the Latinx playwriting tradition. Mm-hmm. And here it was really, it was interesting to feel the affinity across a variety of things. But I found the model to be really generative, and both in terms of thinking back on plays that are well known, but also thinking forward and how am I going to return to her thinking and her book for my immediate projects as well as my future teaching.
And on this sort of question of financialization, and that's a huge part of this book, is, you know, I found the detail fascinating of when did speculation change over from gambling to, like, a stock market sort of practice, and how is sort of Chekhov aware of this? But this is to, I think, Brian's point. She situates the book, or a bulk of the writing of the book, from sort of 1870 to World War I. And she writes that this is when Europe was in the grip of revolutions and socioeconomic experimentations. And to me, always the flip side of that is, yes, that was happening in Europe. What was happening in the colonies at the same time? Yeah. And I really think, you know, my dissertation and book manuscript is called Contesting Capital. And I think of these as, like, in my head now, I can't undo this, of, like, they're companion pieces in a sense. Because, of course, what I write about, and while Brian is coming at it from the Latinx theater perspective, I write about really the first Indian plays was called Neeldarpon, which is about the indigo farmers' revolution against this cash crop that the British were expecting them to grow. And then of sort of the 1940s, there's a play called Nabanno, which is about the Bengal famine, which is again about the British stockpiling crops, right, and a forced famine. So they're both examining really colonial market economies.
Yeah.
But they're entering it, and those are foundational plays, but they give us a different sort of trajectory of what the theater is thinking about through money and through capital. And so I really love this sort of placing together of what is happening in European theater with theater in different parts of the world. And I think the book offers us that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really open. I think what I appreciated about it is she's constantly saying, I'm talking about something super specific, but that, but then doing these gestures that are quite expansive, both in time and geographical and cultural scope. And so I think the book is elegantly done in that it threads this very specific set of conversations, but with nods and gestures and invocations and invitations to think more broadly. And that's not easy to do, I don't think. And so I think it's a really generous book in that way.
Well, I'm glad you both found it generative. I did as well. I think, you know, Shayoni, your comment about the, you know, relationship, the complementarity between a perspective that would look at what's happening in Western Europe, some of these places that are becoming, you know, industrial capitalist metropoles that have a completely necessary relationship with colonies that are, you know, actively controlled partly for resource extraction or trade. You remind me of a curious fact or a fact that's not well known about Diderot's Entretien sur le Fils Naturel. Forgive me the 18th century digression, but you can look at Diderot's, you know, interviews on the natural son as being one of those early, early modern dramas, right? So it's the bourgeois drama. It's concerned with the lives of regular characters. It's sort of one of those early points in the tradition. But there's a colonialist subtext to it as well. The father has been gone in the West Indies. His absence. The play is about the reconciliation of a family with his illegitimate son, and you know, love pairings and all of this. And in that play, I mean, you blink and you miss it. I think the contemporary audience would understand that's where the father was, but it's not discussed openly. And so this book, you know, Julina's book, and the way that the really pervasive and epoch-forming social factors that mercantilism and capitalism have brought, that once you pull that thread, you realize that it is formative of so much that we take for granted, and that those sort of that the materialist questions easily fade into the background, partly because we live deep into the modern era and in the era of late capitalism. So we take it for granted. But I think Julina does a great job of showing how these plays, which I will confess, I was a little skeptical reading, because I thought, how, you know, I don't know how I can be convinced that Chekhov or Ibsen, who I think of as being very much these bourgeois authors, were wrestling with, you know, Marxist ideas or wrestling with the contradictions of capitalism. But I think that's partly because by this time in history, the 21st century, we're long enough into the era that those social relations seem like they're the, you know, foundation. They're the sort of basic set of conditions we all live with. But also there's the contrary example of Brecht in the modernist tradition, who was a Marxist and who had his own experimentation with theatrical form, which was designed to expose the contingencies of those social relations. So by contrast, those other playwrights seem like, ah, yes, they must not have just thought about it, or they wanted to have a kind of ideological, intellectualist, philosophical rumination on the place of the individual in history, as opposed to something that was truly concerned with economics. But Julina does a fantastic job of showing that indeed they thought about it constantly, and it's all over the plays as well. It's very much in that tradition.
Well, and that goes back to something that I found I really appreciated about it, was I do think that in that sort of the, and she does say, like, she stops at Brecht. She sort of goes right up into the precipice of Brecht and stops.
Yes.
And that's how she structures the story, the study, as she calls it. But I also think what she does is a really nice job of, I mean, for me, the Chekhov chapter was a bit of a revelation. I knew a lot about Shaw in terms of his own intellectual work outside of his plays, and I knew a measure of Ibsen's, but some of the chisme or the gossip that she offers is really instructive too, in terms of copyright and in terms of all these sort of material realities of him trying to make money from his plays. But all of which is to say, she is talking about how these folks are thinking about this as well as thinking about writing plays. She contextualized the plays in their other writings and their other life work. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was, for me, was so welcome, because so often playwrights like these are leveraged against playwrights from the Global South, U.S. minority playwrights, for saying, oh, but they're thinking about politics. They're not really thinking about drama like the masters are, you know. And here we get some really great evidence that Chekhov's thinking about this stuff in all mm-hmm. of his plays, and it comes to great mastery in his plays in particular. And so there's a way in which I think it's a great, it affirms my rebuttal that always comes when somebody diminishes a playwright, an emerging playwright who is thinking about the world in rigorous ways, and also having that thinking inflect their dramaturgy. And when sometimes you'll hear a blowback saying, oh, just do the play, don't worry about all of that other stuff. We say, like, if there is anything to be salvaged from the last 150 years of the dramatic tradition, its anchor is in some ways the dialogue of putting of what can the play itself be as an intellectual practice, the writing of a play as an intellectual practice. And here she gives really, I'm just grateful to be able to sort of pull up some of the stuff that she's given me to say that this is not new, and it doesn't come in the 60s. It doesn't come, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's this kind yeah. of the rejection and the dismissal of certain kinds of writers. We knew it was nonsense, but it also, this gives us great evidence to say, like, yeah, this is key in what is celebrated as the arrival of the drama as a serious form in the modern era.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the thing that it is, of course, the power of these plays and revisiting them. And, you know, as I was reading this, and I think we shared this in our email thread, literally at the same time as I was reading it, I read of the disruption of the Enemy of the People on Broadway that yeah. Extinction Rebellion did. And Zelina's first chapter is a revisitation of not just this Ibsen play, but specifically Ostermeyer's staging of it. And, you know, I remember yeah. watching that production at BAM. And I remember the interlude where they switch from German to English for the staged sort of audience interaction part. And I remember even then thinking, wow, this is a really polite, well-behaved audience, because here we are sitting in downtown Brooklyn, nodding along very politely and asking questions within the framework of the play, right? Of, oh, what do we do with contaminated water? And I think what Zelina does so beautifully is set us up for what may be, I hope, an ongoing sort of discussion, conversation, hopefully even confrontation on this Broadway version, where, you know, she says that there have been 8 versions of this play since 2016. People have, in the United States that she knows, people have placed it in the context of Flint and others. What happens when audiences don't play nice? When we really want to grapple mm-hmm. with the issues of the play rather than defer to the playwright or the director or who is staging it? That is the real work of the theater. And I think it was so perfect that, of course, it was Extinction Rebellion and this climate catastrophe that we're hurtling towards that brings yeah. this back into the fold of the theater. And I think there are various accounts of this interruption. Jeremy Strong was the only one who stayed in character while others didn't. So there's a real interesting sort of moment of how do you actually have these questions about capital catastrophe, late or end stage capitalism, and make it feel alive again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and there's the great piece by Adam Feldman, which talks about the experience of being in the theater and of it being a press night. So a lot of critics are there, and this question, and he sort of documents the experience in a really robust way in Time Out. And one of the things that comes up in a couple accounts is people thought it was part of the show. And then it was the sort of the discussion. So I think what's really interesting is the habits of audience and how does the audience turn and evolve, and then the different responses of the different actors. And then the more professional thing where the stage manager came in and they sort of restarted. But it really is a great capsule. And how does a play by Ibsen hold that, remain a container? Like, mm-hmm. it seems like how, and especially plays that are out of copyright, how can they do things that are different for current audience for current theater makers to sort of use the canon, but also to activate the questions that are ongoing and enduring that, as Julina reminds us, are some of the inceptive questions of the capitalization moment, which is irresponsibility by banks, irresponsibility by industry, the presumption that their communal good will triumph, all of these kind of things. And what they're naming is it doesn't always work out. And that's a great space to be in that ambivalence and paradox of.
A tiny detail that I always love to mention, and I think it goes to the contradiction, the internal contradictions of theater that Zelina is pointing out. I was in the audience for the Laura Loomer interruption of Shakespeare in the Park when they were doing Caesar. And that was a 2-minute interruption. She obviously filmed it. It was for a different audience, sort of a digital audience of, oh, look what these liberals or these leftist people in New York are doing. So to me, the difference in reaction to Extinction Rebellion and to Laura Loomer have to do with who the audience is and how we're mm-hmm. implicated or resisting the liberal values of a certain kind of bourgeois theater production.
It's a fantastic thought. I think maybe we'll do a topic on the podcast in a future date about the interruptions of plays, because thinking back over the last several years, there's several different moments that I can think of. And you're precisely right that each one that I'm thinking of has a different configuration of the agent and the audience who stops the play, presumptions about what's going on stage, critiques to make about what's going on stage. And then the audience gets cast in a different role each time. We should move on. But again, it's Elisa Julina's Theater of Capital, fresh out from Northwestern University, and a really, really exciting reevaluation of modern drama. We also spent time with, we watched Sasha Denisova's play, My Mama and the Full-Scale Invasion. This, as I said, was produced at the Wilma Theater in co-production with Woolly Mammoth. I don't know, it's how to describe it. It was, for me, a surprisingly comedic representation of the Ukrainian-born playwright's relationship with her mother in the context of the ongoing invasion of Ukraine by Russia. We saw a stream of it. The cast was three-person play, Holly Twyford as the mother, Sully Holum as the daughter, and Lindsay Smiling as the man who steps into several roles. So I don't know, Shione, I'm curious to know what your thoughts were, your reactions to watching this play.
It was so moving and also so relevant to the times, not only as sort of the Ukrainian invasion sort of ongoing, but just in general thinking about kinship here, you know, specifically a mother-daughter relationship. But also, and this is in the title of it, My Mama and the Full-Scale Invasion, the place of women in placemaking, right? The whole sort of foundational sort of trope of this is the mother refuses to evacuate. She was born in 1941 with the German and the Nazi bombing. Mm-hmm. And here she is refusing to evacuate. And so this is not new. What is the cost of war on women? What is the gendered mm-hmm. burden of placemaking, homemaking, memory making? And, you know, I love, like you said, it's surprisingly comedic. The playwright herself, Denisova, calls it a tragicomedy. We see mm-hmm. this and we, you know, I think there is a contemporary or maybe always an over-reliance on this word resilience, right? I'm coming to really bristle at this, like nobody has sort of, we're forced into these situations. But what does humor allow us to do in navigating these absurd kind of militaristic incursions? And then, of course, one of the sort of things I think about is, you know, the mother as taking on in her home domestic space this kind of faux militaristic, like, commander-in-chief thing. And, you know, in this lovely interview, the playwright says, you know, my mother feels like she can talk to the leaders of the world through her big plasma screen, and she is, you know, the commander-in-chief, thinking about the news every day and parsing through all of the sort of bits of information. So to what extent do we even think about large-scale global military-industrial complexes, global geopolitics, through the lens of domesticity, but also sort of inverting or playing or, you know, parodying it a little bit, quite honestly. And I think the play really does that in the different sort of way the interactions we see.
Well, I mean, we talked a little bit just a moment ago about how modernism as a form, modern drama was sort of a critically invented overlay on a period of drama. And I kept thinking about how, like, Theater of the Absurd is also just a critically invented framework that came to explain a constellation of plays in a given historical moment. Excuse me, edit that. A certain constellation of plays in a given historical moment that all were trying to use what came to be known as absurd gestures to make theatrically comprehensible things that would otherwise be incomprehensible. And so this kind of way where I think that it's not a jokey play, there's some joke lines, but it's in its absurdity. And it's the fact that she, Denisova, is a self-acknowledged experimental playwright who writes on political themes. And I think that there is a way where mask work and projections and all of these things are this sort of, are used to sort of heighten the kind of the absurdity, but also the emotional undercurrents that guide that absurdity. Because I just found it to be incredibly moving to think that Mama was, has lived the 80 years of modern Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. And like the thing that kept making me laugh out loud was Mama's insistence on using the neologism Russists, combining Russians and fascists, and sort of doing this, you know, and then the idea that she has last year's pickles, not this year's pickles, last year's pickles that she will use to take out the drones, understanding the different scale of warfare, you know, that, yeah, a pickle could take out a drone if done right. You know, so it's this interesting kind of thing where it's both sensible and absurd. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what, when I think about some of the most compelling artworks about war, the ones that I resonate with are the ones that play with absurdity to make comprehensible the absurdity of war and the cruelty and the emotional dimensions of war. And it's really, and I will say that one thing that's worth pointing out as we're reflecting on this is the play was revised. There was a substantial revision, especially with, because these are events are ongoing. So between the Wilma and between the Woolly Mammoth production a few months ago and the Wilma just now, there has been substantial revision. So it's an ongoing piece, and it's a piece that I think is I just think it's really an interesting, it's a really interesting piece, and I hope it has either future digital life or perhaps more future productions, because it is, so often theater takes so long to make that I think it's so impressive that these two major regional theaters chose to go ahead and do a play with a refugee playwright who doesn't write in English and is writing about current events in cities like DC and Philadelphia. And it's just a really fascinating leverage of the production apparatus in engagement with the times.
That is really interesting. I didn't realize that it was translated from the original the version we saw was a translation.
Yeah, it was a translation and an adaptation. So she wrote it and then worked with the set designer who translated it. And then also another member of the production team helped sort of make some other, is attributed, I think, in kind of with dramaturgical contributions. But the credit is adapted by. So it's a collaboratively authored and undertaken piece. But the translator credited is the person who did the set design, who's also, I believe, Ukraine. Great.
And they call it the theater of immediate response, right? And this is exactly what Brian is saying, is what is the durational aspect of this? How do you even make a theater of immediate response while keeping in mind translation, adaptation, staging? And it still is talking, talking to sort of what's happening now rather than even months ago.
It's interesting because part of my reaction to it was the way that this year, 2023, the way that the invasion of Gaza has sort of eclipsed, at least, or has become the conflict in my mind that is the one that feels most urgent. And so this is not a criticism of the play at all. And in fact, there's a line in the play deep in it where the occupied territories are mentioned as if to acknowledge, this is not the only conflict zone in the world.
Yeah.
But that we seem to be in this time where there's conflicts on top of conflicts. And if you're invested in what's going on in different parts of the world, it can become overwhelming. It's really fascinating, though, that especially to watch it streaming. And I don't know about you, but trying to fit it into my schedule this week, I'm watching it in chunks. And so I'm conscious of the fact that by watching a stream, which they've staged the production and made the stream available, that's part of the intended viewing experience. But I feel like it's not actually proper to, or it would be better to see it in person. And it would be better not for me to have broken it up because it feels then that the sort of spatial dislocation or the networked aspect of it, the way that it's sort of in multiple spaces at once, it sort of stretched for me a little bit. And I felt like I shouldn't be watching this in 15 or 20 minute chunks. Like, to get the experience of it, I should really sit down and experience it. And then there's a moment at the very end where the playwright has a Zoom call with her mother, who of course is this important character, central character in the play. You get to see her face and hear her voice, and it's a sort of special payoff at the very end. But it had me wondering about what kind of temporal dislocation is happening as well. Was that a live call in the performance of the play that I'm witnessing a stream of, or was it a video recording of a Zoom call that was then played as a recorded tape?
So you're just you're in a loop of layers of liveness. Layers of liveness. Yeah.
Yeah. And having done this podcast and seen a lot of streaming theater since the onset of the pandemic, I've really come to feel like the pandemic was bad, but that the all of these theaters who ramped up ways of sharing their work to a streaming audience is really good, because I feel like the production, the production quality and the techniques of making those experiences shareable, for someone like me who doesn't get to see a lot of these things otherwise in streaming, I like it. But then there was a moment in watching it, my own particular viewing experience, where I thought, this is like, I'm not having the proper theatrical experience.
Well, I mean, I think that is one of the questions. And one thing I do want to note for listeners as well, and also just to support Wilma really leaned really rebuilt what they did during the pandemic with regard, like, they were the ones who did the first major production of Fat Ham as a theatrical film, as a sort of a live theater film thing that then went to Broadway and Pulitzer, and then it came back to Wilma and restaged. But one of the things Wilma has done in the last two seasons has been that for the month after the show closes, it is available to stream. So, and what they did this because they felt that they were serving their Philadelphia audience better by offering these options, but then they've also realized that they're engaging an international audience as well. And so they have cultivated skills during the pivot of away from in-person theater, and they've cultivated those skills and they're continuing. And the interesting thing, the first time, so I would say they're doing Good Potion of Szechuan, they're doing a new musical called Holda. It's a really interesting set of artistic leaders. So I would say keep an eye on what Wilma's doing, because you'll be able to watch it if you wish. And they also partnered with the League of Live Stream Theater, which is partnering with a variety of companies to actually do live streams, like appointment, like they will film the performance as it's happening, and you have to sit at wherever you are time zone wise, you have to watch it as it's happening. So they're leveraging their techniques to capture performance, and also partnering with the League of Live Stream Theater to provide the direct access on a sort of more time bound, sort of whatever happens in the audience, you'll see as it happens in front of you. So I'm just impressed by Wilma's willingness to be nimble and experimental in how to understand remote performance, which is how I use the term I use is remote performance as opposed to digital or virtual, to think about questions of spatiality, but and spatial relationship. But they are seeing it as an asset to how to amplify mm-hmm. the voices of their playwrights and to engage a broader, both locally and beyond the Philadelphia area. I mean, I go, and sometimes I go in person. I was supposed to go to see this in person. I'm sorry I didn't, but it was a complicated week. But I knew I would be able to see it again later. And that's sort of, often I do that. Often I see it, mm-hmm. and then I buy another ticket to watch it on the live stream just to revisit it. Or recorded mm-hmm. performance to revisit it, and it's a great resource, and I think they're a great leader in this moment of change as what the future looks like continues to evolve.
It sort of takes us into a different topic, and we should move on before too long mm-hmm. to our third topic. But I wonder, I get the sense from having viewed other works in the sort of video format. I'm thinking of Madeline Sayet's Sovereignty, which we viewed mm-hmm. A stream of for our episode on Native theater or Indigenous theater. I'm thinking, of course, of Fake Friends and their streaming offerings, that it seems like it's built into the contracts that are happening around this, that there's a limited time horizon to view mm-hmm. a lot of these performances. I'm sure that makes sense for a lot of reasons, having to do with the intellectual property and the rights of the artists and the producing organizations. But there are times when I kind of wish things would have a longer accessibility. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's possible to frame contracts to where after a certain amount of time, this becomes the catalog of the theater that they can then sell streams of and share the profits with the artists.
I will say that yeah. it's a contractual impasse right now. That mm-hmm. I work with Bart at the Gate. I work, you know, and so I'm aware that it's a bit of a contractual impasse. I don't think it's irresolvable, and I do hope that I think that theaters are interested in finding ways, not just for passive income, but for finding mm-hmm. ways to sort of loop back to what we were talking about before, not just for passive income, but for also to expand reach and expand access, especially for educational and school content. But right now it's a contractual impasse because of actor and designer labor, that it's unions representing those and negotiating those haven't quite found a way in to manage that. But I do think that the dexterity, for example, what we see is there's a variety of different, what's crucial to know is that, like, the three ones that you mentioned, Sayet, Fake Friends, and this Wilma production, all used very different production apparatuses to capture the performance for a mm-hmm. remote audience. And so I think artists are figuring things out in really dynamic and exciting ways. And so then it's going to be an issue of contracts being able to loop back and support them. But I think, just as a transition to our next topic, one of the things that I found, like, one of the things that the three of us, for everybody listening, I was at the convening in Boston this past weekend of the 10th anniversary convening of the Latinx Theater Commons, but both Chayone and panel were able to sort of dip in, and as was I, because I missed the opening ceremony. So we could all mm-hmm. watch it because it had been live streamed in real time, but then was posted immediately to YouTube. And what's interesting about that in what we were just talking about is part of the as the section we watched, and Karen Zacharias talked about how HowlRound and the Latinx Theater Commons sort of are not quite twins, but they sort of have similar histories and similar kind of, they sort of came into existence at the same moment. And so one of the things that's really interesting about the LTC is live streaming and of documentation via video has been part of what the LTC has been doing since 2013. Mm-hmm. At the first large convening in 2013, there was live streams available. And so I think what's also a good historical corrective is to say that this question of experimentation of how can we provide different kinds of access, and with the LTC live streaming parts of its original convening in 2013, and this is like anytime there's a convening, there's always a section that's live streamed. It's designed to open the circle. As mm-hmm. because the LTC is understood as circles within circles, and that leveraging the tools of HowlRound TV and the tools that HowlRound has built into its existence, how can those circles be broadened beyond those who happen to have the resources or opportunity to be co-present?
Yeah,
and
that's so,
cool. It's an interesting thing that precedes the pandemic, but it registers in a different fluency or familiarity post-pandemic.
I appreciate that, Brian, because I, you know, listening to the opening ceremonies, it was another one of these experiences where I'm like, to what extent am I really, engaged with and thinking about what I'm hearing and the purpose of this organization, and to what extent am I distracted by the innovative and really interesting mode of communication and space sharing that is allowing me to see it. So I do want to talk about that more, but Brian, I wonder if you wouldn't just, for us and the listeners who aren't as familiar, talk about what the Latinx Theater Commons is and maybe give some of your sense of what this moment meant, given that you were also there and documented and published a narrative of the first convening in 2013 of this organization.
Yes, the Latinx Theater Commons is a loose, always evolving consortium of theater makers of all different stages in their career, all different sort of places in the profession as well as outside of the profession, that have come together around the idea that Karen Zacharias had, original playwright and advocate Karen Zacharias had, of like, we don't have a lot of spaces. The industries that we work in don't create a lot of spaces for us to come together and get to know each other and to talk about what we're sharing and what we're doing. And so this idea of having convening as a sort of a core of what becomes the four pillars of the LTC, it was sparked by Karen Zacharias sort of leveraging a grant that she had to sort of begin this process. That led to some funder interest, which allowed me to join the following year and another 80 people to come together and to sort of have kind of what we might call a kind of a community meeting. But really not intra-industry. It wasn't a community meeting of Latinx scholars or a community meeting of at the theater communication groups of people involved with regional theaters. These were people in cultural-specific organizations, scholars, people who were working on Broadway. It was all across. And the whole, what was transformative for me in that first encounter was theater and the other space I spend time in, the academy, are both prestige economies where status and where you fit in a hierarchy ends up overtaking a lot of things. And what the LTC's brilliant hack was, we're all in the circle together because we agreed to offer something to the circle. And so it meant that there was kind of a lateralness to it, where somebody who had been in the field for a couple of years was understood to be in the circle on the same standing as somebody like Luis Valdez or Luis Alfaro, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was, we could hear this in the live stream when Melinda Lopez talked a little bit about how it freaked her out to be put in a circle with some people. Yeah. And that was what actually it has proven to be the continual force of the LTC over the convenings over the last 10 years. There's been a convening every year or so, including during the pandemic, that has brought people together. Typically, the first cycle of convenings was around regional convenings, different parts of the country, sometimes within a festival model, sometimes in a new plays model, sometimes in a kind of focusing on a festival model in Los Angeles, a presentation of some new scripts in Chicago. There was a TYA one in Texas. You know, there was a community, there was one in New York. So it was bouncing all over the place. And then in the more recent cycles, it's been a little bit more topically focused, like one on Carnival, one on questions of collaboration and building collaborative relationships. So there's typically responding from the community, what seems to be the needs, the proposals are solicited, all of this. But it's not a producing organization, and nor is it a scholarly organization. It uses the term movement intentionally to say that this is not necessarily invested in... It relies on what people are contributing and what the priorities are named, and it also is designed to be responsive to need. And so these are two things that as an organization or as an entity that I have been involved with in varying degrees of intensity over the last 10 years as unlike any other that I participate in. And so it also continues to be a place where the veteranos come in and then the people who are sort of in the mix and then the new kids come on, and it's like every time it's the same thing. And if you watch the stream, you'll see that it's like got a sense of conviviality of a kind of to not overuse metaphors of family, but like of things like reunion or of gathering. And there's a degree of pachanga or partying always. And so there's a way in which it's been. And I think what I can say is it's been. Its impact and imprint on the field for Latinx theater makers is pretty enormous.
Yeah.
Just because it activated relation, it's an activating agent, and one of those activations it does with is relationships. And it's as a historian, I look back and say like, oh yeah, that wouldn't happen without that. Wouldn't have happened without. And we have yet to have there's been some scholarship on it, but no real history yet. And so, but yeah. So blah blah blah. I'm a fan. It's also complicated and weird and strange and tricky, but that's why it stays interesting.
Yeah, I have. I think I had a similar to you, Panel, this feeling of looking. You know, I did feel included in some kind of virtual space, but this, you know, being at the furthest circle, let's say, of these concentric circles. And it actually reminded me of, while we were talking about the Wilma Theater in My Mama and the Full Scale Invasion, the other theater company producing it was also the Woolly Mammoth, right? And I was thinking about them. They had recently done a run of Public Obscenities, which we've talked about. Yeah. And so I was thinking about in this, how do we expand audiences and accessibility? How much does language and sort of regional, national, other kinds of identities come into play. Mm-hmm. And just from listening to these opening remarks of the LTC, the, you know, both the perils and promises, if you will. So somebody talked about, you know, the sense of like, I don't have to like everybody here in the circle.
I remember that quote too.
Right? Like, oh, wow, but we are sharing this space in the circle together. And I thought about, you know, I think it really highlighted for me well this question of what do we think of affinity or identity-based theater making, both as sort of in-circle, in-group conversations, but also as much deliberately building out bridges, collaborating with other people, or having a model. It's still not linear, but having this concentric model of concerns or places we can contribute. And then just, you know, I liked the complete outsider. Somebody spelt out the four tenets as like scholarship, convening, art making, and advocacy. And I was like, oh yeah, those are really solid ways of thinking about culture and theater making. So I really appreciated all of that.
Well, and those are like in the terminology of the LTC, those are the pillars. Those, anything we do needs to stand equally on that. And that was, again, one of the transformative ones. Transformative aspect was scholarship's in there. Advocacy is in there. The idea of convening, not networking, convening, coming together. And then art making, you know, it was like, but the thing, because that was transformative. I will say that for all of us in 2013, all of us who I knew from ATHA or from Aster or from other scholarly contexts, we were all like, we've never been invited in to be part of the conversation, to be understanding that we are not necessarily only coming along after the fact or the creeper in the back of the room. You know, it's like there was a sort of a sense that if this is going to have an impact, scholars who are often hyphenate, they're often makers too. And so it's these simple gestures of naming intentionality, but also naming the fact that we're not going to get along and we're going to disagree, but we also have shared, for lack of a better phrase, skin in the game. There's something that we are committed to this movement. Even though it's, and that's, of course, reaching back to the history of Latinx theater, which is often, as it's understood, post-Chicano era, like movement-driven. But it's, and so it speaks to a lot of that. But it's this idea, too, that everybody, like, this is, and I will say that the organization is in a spate, is because there's a lot of pressures on, I use the organization, there's a lot of pressures on the LTC to become an institution, to become an organization. One of the struggles that the LTC has always had is legibility, but also resistance from becoming a funder, becoming a producer, becoming a regional theater. You know, like, there's a lot of folks want it to become. And one of the testaments to its success is the fact that it refuses that, and it has a kind of a, for better and worse, a consensus-driven and organizational structure with one paid employee. And so it's It opens up, and I think that this connects to why the resonance with Wilma and Wooly makes sense. They are relatively small in terms of scale and budget, and they are also, in the last 5 years, have reanimated mission as guiding actions. Because I think we have a lot of regional theaters who work under not-for-profit who operate with a mission, but we don't always see... we don't oversee some of the actions taken by all of these organizations, like Wooly opening its lobbies during times of action to create a safe space for folks to take a break from a march to come and be in the Wooly lobby. Mm-hmm. Like that, those are kind of, and those have come from mission driven initiatives that the relatively new artistic director say, if we're doing this, we're doing it this way. And I think that that goes to why pillars can be so important, is what is your mission? What are the things, what are we doing? Does it meet our pillars? And that is sort of what the LTC always does. And I do think that boards are often in charge of maintaining the mission, but then also boards are maintaining, if not-for-profits are maintaining the corporate survival of the entity. And so it goes back to the Julina sort of question of whose motives are there, and does the profit side come in, or does the mission community-based orientation win?
It's interesting. I was thinking about the same sort of, or a different take on the same sort of thematic connection with Theater of Capital, which is that the movement or the sort of organizing identity of it, the horizontalist governing structure, the way that the mode of the convening involved sort of taking a breath and thinking, what are we here to do? Like this, these are things that remind me of sort of left organizing spaces. So it is interesting to think of an organization that presents itself that way, though thank you for reminding me of the four pillars, because advocacy is one of those. In certain ways, it reminded me of Lambda, the Literary Managers of Dramaturgs of the Americas. But that's an organization that represents a professional role and a function in theater production. It's not in the main defined by an identity. But it also reminded me of, or the thing I kept thinking about was decomposition instead of collapse. Do your theater be like soil? That really... galvanizing and interesting generative essay by Annalisa Diaz, who I assume is a Latinx theater producer as well, based on their name. But that, you know, it put me in mind of the problems that these big legacy organizations are facing, the trouble that permanent theaters, regional theaters are having bringing audiences and funding back. And it made me think, not that there needs to be, I have mixed feelings about that essay and about the mentality of theater just being dissolved and having to remake itself from nothing, because I think there's a lot of investment we may not realize that we actually still have in those big legacy institutions. But is something like the Latinx Theater Commons an example of a sort of, you know, formation from the soil, something that's nimble, horizontalist, expansive, connects people all over, isn't tied to and doesn't have either the inertial constraints of nor the productive resources of a producing entity with its own space, you know? The thinking of those things in contrast, I thought was one of the places my mind went. Thank you so much, Brian, for giving us this dispatch. And I don't want to shut conversation short, but we all have things we have to get to do, and we need to do our drafts. Listeners, you know what our drafts are. I explain it on every single episode. Maybe this is the first episode, though, that you've already listened all the way an hour into. And so if that's you, our drafts are just our personal spots for our musings, our projects, our profession and theater and performance and intellectual related musings, things that we've read, things that we've seen that are sort of sticking in our minds. Shioni, would you like to lead us off with your draft on the episode?
Yes, and I feel like I have a very on-tap draft because...
Oh, I'm psyched. I'm psyched.
It is an event, and Brian, I know you're coming to campus tomorrow. We will have another event, which we're calling Decolonizing Gender. And I'm sort of convening it with my colleague Mara Green in anthropology, where, and this is the very on tap part of it, we have Vaibhav Sarya, whose book Hijra's Lovers, Brothers, we talked about.
Yes.
We have
yes.
Kareem Khoobchandani, and Will, who was obviously a co-host at one point, but we'll be talking about decolonized drag. And we'll be talking with Misha Shayok Chaudhary, the writer-director of Public Obscenities. And, you know, the drafty version of this is really, what do we make of colonial categories of bodies and how are we undoing them? And one little anecdote I would love to share, and, you know, each of these works think about this in different ways, whether it's hijras, whether it's drag, whether it's kothis, or academic research into sort of third world or sub-genres or subcultures of different gender identities. We commissioned this person who's a public artist and a friend in Kolkata to make the poster, and he does old school hand-painted posters. And because of the convenience of this, I was of course just communicating with him in English, and we wrote the word kothi in. And I was like, okay, this is one of the words because we have different scripts in there. And then it took us four drafts and three Bengalis to figure out which alphabet of the, in the Bengali alphabet, which letter is actually that T sound. Is it the hard T? Is it T? Is it T? And so it was just this beautiful accident of like really highlighting what do we even, and there are regional variances of Kothi versus Kothi, that what are even the stakes of trying to name gender categories? So I'm really excited about this new way of sort of, it's not new, but putting these people in conversation together of like stretching and decolonizing gender discourse.
That's phenomenal. Shayoni, is that poster available to see online anywhere? Is there a link or?
Yes.
Or will there be?
It is on my Twitter, but I will also send it out because truly the art itself is something we talked about. How do you even imagine a different kind of body? And I think it's very much to sort of Kareem's work even of decolonizing drag, of what are now our fairly like unfortunately mainstream expectations of drag versus other ways of thinking about gender performance.
That's fantastic. I see the poster here. Oh, it's gorgeous. I'll make sure that we link to this on the podcast website. My draft actually has a pretty strong point of connection with this one, so I might just insert myself in the order here. My draft just has to do with Judith Butler. I was reading their work for the performance theory seminar that I'm teaching. So we read the 1998 Performative Acts and Gender Constitution, and then we read portions of Gender Trouble, the 1990, you know, first major work that was so influential. And as part of my preparation for that seminar, which I increasingly do in my super busy state, is I'll find some podcast and I'll be like, I need extra things to think about. I'll go for a run. And Butler was just interviewed by David Remnick of The New Yorker on a podcast that you can find easily searching wherever you find podcasts. But Remnick was interviewing Butler about their new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? And it's Butler at their most sort of engaging and, you know, clear and I really recommend listening to it because the line of thought, and it's about this new book, is what do we think of the ramifications, the present political reactions, especially against gender theory, that are international and that Butler now identifies with totalitarian regimes around the world. So I really recommend that interview, but it had me thinking about the, you know, where Butler is in our field. And I think I had become comfortable with this narrative, which is that once, you know, Butler publishes that first very important article in TJ, Performative Acts and Gender Constitution, and there's explicit links to Goffman, Victor Turner, Richard Schechner. They're working in the constellation of ideas at that time that's emerging as performance theory. And then when you read Gender Trouble, a lot of those theoretical references are not there. And instead, it's post-structuralism, its theory. And Butler, in the prefaces, the subsequent prefaces to Re-editions of Gender Theory, or Gender Trouble, talks about and identifies their work as part of this sort of, you know, strange American entity, which is theory and its relationships with French thought and post-structuralism, et cetera. And so you don't have Victor Turner, you don't have Schechter, you don't have Goffman, but you've got Foucault and Lacan and a different set of thinkers, but similar core ideas. And so I had thought of like, oh yeah, Butler is sort of, you know, they became a star, they became massively influenced, they participated in the formation of the sort of theory moment in this very important way, and left those sort of links to the field behind, but they're still there. And there's two points that I want to point out. One is when you read the very last section of Gender Trouble, it's the last part of the last chapter, chapter three, where they really do, in my mind, the sort of clearest explication of the notion that gender is a performed thing and not expressive. There's a discussion of Mary Douglas, who is a symbolic anthropologist and part of that lineage that comes from structural functionalism, of the same generation as Turner and Clifford Geertz, but not as frequently cited in our field. But there's still that structure, there's still that symbolic anthropology link. And then there's the title of this new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? Try to convince me that's not a theatrical reference. I think it must be. So maybe I'll see if I can, you know, get Butler to join us on the podcast and talk about their theatrical roots, but that's my draft. Brian.
Okay. I the risk of having me go third in drafts is, of course, now I have two drafts, but I just want to do a quick shout out, and I'll do this in the very on tap spirit of calling back to work we've already done. I read a couple of the interviews that were attached to the release of the 75th anniversary edition of TJ. Should now be available to you through your library subscription. And right. And so we talked about that on the podcast. All those articles are there. And in particular, it's a really interesting constellation of interviews with the former editors. And that pivot, that moment in TJ's history when they published Judith Butler, comes up as a recurring thread. I strongly recommend looking at those. But then the thing I'm going to say, just in the spirit of intellectual abundance, which I think has characterized our conversation today, we keep invoking texts and conversations which are just so rich in their dimensions and their multi-layers, is I finally started reading a book I've been dying to read and I've had for a long time. I finally started reading this weekend while traveling, Naomi Klein's book, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. And I just think it's essential for performance studies scholars to read, because she's really just doing the great deep dive intellectual query, but also asking about embodied questions of cognition, embodied questions of emotion, these questions and really rich things of, like, I love how she talks about personal narrative and critiquing her own work in terms of the brand. And so there's just something for me. I'm still barely into it. I'm still only in part one. But it feels like a performance studies text to me, and I just look forward mm-hmm. to going deeper. I mean, it's a powerful book where she talks about the contemporary political moment and her own experience being often mistaken for somebody with a similar name but very different ideological stance in the world. And then her tools for that are a really adventurous and abundant excavation of the idea of the double in global culture mm-hmm. and in contemporary politics and in various disciplines. And it's just really rich, and it's the kind of intellectual practice that we don't get to do much in the academy, and so we rely on people who are academy adjacent to do it with us. Yes. But I am part one in, and I may change my mind by the end, but right now I had my spidey sense told me this was going to have a lot for me personally. I did not expect that would have as much for me in terms of thinking about what is performance studies and what are we talking about, what are we actually doing when we do performance studies. So that's my draft.
If I could, phenomenal. You know, yeah. I will do the full circle of this, because there was a teenage Shione who was equally taken by Naomi Klein's No Logo. And mm-hmm. to me, No Logo is really adjacent to Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, and actually Zelina's sort of Theater of Capital, right? This mm-hmm. like logos as brand identity, as as what we wear is who we are. And yeah, so it's a lovely sort of constellation of things to think about. Where does capital and where does brand and image making and identity sit in all of this?
Oh, absolutely. Well,
Shione, Brian, thank you so much. This has been a joy, as I fully expected it would be. Listeners, you can go to our website. I'll post some of the links from the many things that came up that we talked about on the podcast. And check us out. We'll have another episode for you in about a month. On Tap is supported by the Performing Arts Department at Washington University in St. Louis and its master's program in theater and performance studies. You can find us on the web at ontappod.com, email us at hosts@ontappod.com. You can also find us on Blue Sky Social at ontappodcast.com.